From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Brooke Baker is joining us to explore the key determinants of prescription drug prices, especially the prices of drugs used in the battle against HIV and other epidemic diseases affecting the poor countries of the global south. We'll explore the rationale and impact of drug patents and the international trade negotiations that protect drug patents and the high prices that accompany them. But first, some news from the world of public health.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm Dr. Andrew Coates. The New England Journal of Medicine, on April 5, 2007, published an article entitled Making Motherhood Safe in Developing Countries. An estimated 500,000 or more women still die each year from complications of pregnancy and childbirth, 95% of them in Africa and Asia, write the authors, Alan Rosenfield, Caroline Mann, and Lynn Friedman. Quote, a comparison of the level of risk in various regions reveals glaring disparities. The lifetime risk of dying during pregnancy is 1 in 16 in sub-Saharan Africa, as compared with 1 in 2,800 in developed regions. This differential is one of the widest among indicators of public health status. Wide disparities in maternal mortality also exist within countries, often in association with differences in wealth or other dimensions of social advantage. But deaths are only part of the tragedy, the authors continue. For every woman who dies, at least 30 others are injured. Many of the injuries are disabling, and in the case of obstetrical fistula, socially devastating. In Making Motherhood Safe in Developing Countries, the authors discuss constraints and barriers to emergency obstetrical care, including trained, skilled professionals, access to care, and the costs of care. They add their voices to a growing chorus of concern worldwide about the problem of maternal mortality. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, has called for a special event on the crisis in Iraq. Taking place April 17th and 18th, 2007 in Geneva, Switzerland, will be the International Conference on Addressing the Humanitarian Needs of Refugees and Internally Displaced Persons Inside Iraq and in Neighboring Countries. In calling the conference, the UNHCR explained, quote, world attention continues to be focused on the violence and human suffering in Iraq. But the broader humanitarian consequences, including increasing displacement within Iraq and to neighboring countries, have yet to be fully appreciated and addressed, unquote. In the lead-up to the conference, Amnesty International and other organizations have issued reports outlining the severity of the crisis, pointing out that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been forced to flee the country in recent months, and 1.5 million Iraqis have been internally displaced. Abstinence-only sex education programs do not impact the sexual behavior of adolescents and teens, according to a federal study just released. The study, conducted by Mathematica Policy Research Incorporated, compared students who had had abstinence-only sex education with those who had not. The age at first intercourse in both groups was identical, 14.9 years. The percent of students who were abstinent in both groups was identical, 49%. The number of sexual partners was the same. Among those sexually active, about one quarter had three or more sexual partners in both groups. The same numbers in each group had unprotected sex, and comparable levels of knowledge about STDs were found in both groups. An opponent of abstinence-only sex education, James Wagoner, president of Advocates for Youth, was quoted as saying, after 10 years and $1.5 billion in public funds, These failed abstinence-only-until-marriage programs will go down as an ideological boondoggle of historic proportions. Abstinence-only sex education got its start under President Bill Clinton as part of his legislation to, quote, end welfare as we know it. Under the George Bush administration, the program has been greatly elevated and expanded. A grassroots movement to call attention to global warming and to demand that carbon emissions be reduced dramatically announced itself on April 14th, called Step It Up 2007, and inspired by environmentalist Bill McKibben, over 1,500 local activities took place to demand that carbon emissions be reduced by 80% by the year 2050. For listeners interested in the medical and public health impacts of global warming, we would like to recommend a fact sheet from the Physicians for Social Responsibility. This fact sheet, available at www.psr.org, is the kind of thing that could be shared widely in order to discuss the public health impact of global warming. Now back to Marvin Malik on Public Health Radio.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik, host for today's show. According to data from the United Nations AIDS program, approximately 40 million people are currently infected with the HIV virus, and roughly 95% of them live in the poor countries of the global south. Over 3 million people worldwide are dying of HIV infection every year. 500,000 of them are children. The number of AIDS deaths in Africa alone will soon surpass the 20 million people who died of the Black Death during the 14th century. Unfortunately, even though we are facing a public health crisis with few parallels in history, our response has been slow and inadequate, and the toll has come in the form of millions of preventable deaths. The vast majority of HIV-infected individuals are not being treated. And one major reason they're not being treated is that they can't afford the medications to treat the disease. Why are pharmaceutical companies allowed to charge such high prices for their medications, even medications essential for the battle against AIDS and other pandemic diseases such as TB and malaria? International trade agreements on intellectual property turn out to have a major impact on drug prices. On today's show, we'll look at the drug patent system and the position the U.S. and other wealthy countries have taken in free trade negotiations. We'll also explore some of the strategies that have been developed to acquire these medications at lower cost. Brooke Baker is joining us today. Baker is a professor of law at Northwestern University Law School, and he also teaches law in South Africa. He's an acclaimed expert in the economics of trade policy and has published extensively on the public health impact of international trade agreements and policies of the World Trade Organization. Brooke Baker, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
The issue of drug patents and how they're handled in various countries seems to be pretty complicated, so I'd like to ask both you and the listeners to be a little patient, and perhaps we can walk through some of the steps. So maybe we could start out by discussing patents on, say, medical innovations. And medications are obviously an important type of medical innovation that may end up with a patent. But maybe if I could ask you to start off explaining the rationale that drug companies use when they support strict patent laws. What argument do they make? Why do they deserve to have patents?
Well, I think they have a series of arguments. Of course, one argument is simply that the U.S. Constitution itself provides for patent protections, and therefore that the legal system in the U.S., if not everywhere in the world, actually prioritize, you know, the availability of patents for innovators from the very beginning. But I think what drug companies argue much more is that without a system to give them some rights to have exclusive control over their product and the processes that they use, there will not be sufficient incentives for innovation to continue. So basically their argument is that we need protection from competitors who could otherwise simply copy our processes or copy our products, so that we would be willing to spend the time and invest the intellectual resources and human resources necessary to make breakthrough discoveries. And in further support, they basically say that there's a trade-off involved, that the legal system requires the patent holder to disclose sufficient information when filing for a patent application that another person who's skilled in the arts or the sciences could read that patent application and be able to use the invention him or herself 20 years later. And so for the benefit of disclosure as opposed to secrecy and the promotion of further invention that comes with publication, that the drug companies or other patent holders would get a period of protection from competition. I think that they make a supplemental argument at this point in time, which is that the costs of research and development and the ability to make new discoveries is getting, the costs are increasing, and the time periods and effort involved are getting longer, and therefore that might explain the need for even stronger patent protections. And they certainly have looked to expand their markets to developing countries and other areas of the world, and to some extent they argue that for them to have the maximum incentives, they need then maximum protections everywhere in the world.
Could you just be a little bit more specific about what the company gets from patenting? In other words, the main thing is that other companies cannot just manufacture the drug that they spent all those years researching. So how many years are they allowed to be the only producer?
Okay. Well, there used to be a lot of variation between countries on how long the patents were. But because of a new international agreement that was passed in 1994 called the TRIPS Agreement, that was part of the creation of the World Trade Organization, the patent term now is 20 years from the date of filing in the patent office until the expiration of the patent. So basically what the patent holder is permitted to do is to prevent others or exclude others from manufacturing, distributing, selling, or importing the product or using the process that results in a product for that same period of time. And so it's important, one thing that's important that's sometimes complicated for people is that patents really protect both a product and sometimes an innovative process or manufacturing method as well. So you have two big different kinds of patents, one on processes and one on products. And so, you know, basically what the drug companies say is we need that long period of time for patent protection. And they also say we need it in particular because the space and time between the original patenting of a pharmaceutical product and that product coming to the market is a fairly long time period, because the drug company has to go through a process of clinical trials to establish that the drug is safe and that it's effective in treating some medical condition and that it's produced with good quality. And that time period varies from drug to drug, but it averages, you know, 6 to 10 years roughly. And therefore they say, compared to some other patent holders, they actually get a shorter period of protection. They get 14 or fewer years. And therefore they say that the long patent term is particularly important for them. And they actually like to recapture some of that delay period through some special provisions in U.S. law that allow some extensions of patent term.
Well, I think you've laid out the argument that pharmaceutical companies use to support strict patent rights. I think you've did that pretty well. So now let's just take a look at the other side of the picture. And I guess in some ways there's two parts to that. One is the problems of access to potentially life-saving products that these companies can then make very expensive, which presumably would be an especially great problem in extremely poor countries. But let's just leave that aside for a second, and let's just go back to whether these companies are actually as justified as they claim in deserving patents. And I guess the question I had is, when I look at most medical discoveries that I use in my day-to-day practice in internal medicine, almost all of the medications, all of the testing, virtually everything that I do, at some point along the line, usually early and then in the middle stages of development, was actually done at government expense. And I was wondering if you could give some examples of that and give me your thoughts on that issue.
Right. Well, of course, the United States, through the National Institutes of Health and universities, commits a huge set of resources to scientific innovation and discovery that provides many of the key basic ideas for important medical discoveries, including drugs. Historically, the U.S. government paid for over 50% of medicine-related research and development. That slipped a little bit recently, but it's still very, very significant, again, both at NIH and in universities. Drug companies tend to pick up the research later in the process. So the way it works now is frequently NIH scientists and university scientists make an important medical breakthrough. They find a promising chemical entity. They have some indication that it may be effective against a particular disease. And then they basically, at that point, turn the product over or license that product to a research and development drug company. And then that company, which may not have done the basic work, begins to do follow-on work and sometimes comes up with new ideas, but sometimes just puts in the sweat to try to bring the product to market.
Does the drug company then have to reimburse the government for doing all that research and turning the product over to them?
No.
To do the last steps?
No, typically, I mean, when a university gives the license, for example, typically the university will get a fairly modest royalty for its contribution. And as well, there are, as you're probably aware, there's a lot of small research companies that come up with some basic products that then get gobbled up by the big research and development companies. So in fact, most of the basic innovation is universities, small research companies, and NIH. And then in a way, the research and development pharmaceutical industry now is really the product development. They take the idea, they add new content and processes to it, and they bring it to the market after proving it's safe and efficacious. Now, that said, there's a lot of drugs that don't work out to be effective. So another thing that the drug companies say, and that bears some truth, is that for every 5,000 drug entities that they look at, only one ends up being approved as a medicine for the market. And so there's a lot of blind alleys. But to kind of get back to you about what the drug companies get out of this, I mean, they get a right to charge monopoly prices, prices that almost have no limit, whatever the market can bear, especially for life-saving medicines. I mean, some of the new cancer medicines cost in excess of $100,000 a year. And they charge that partially because they argue that it's a relatively small patient population, but frankly because they can charge it. There's no competition for the drug, and in the absence of competition, you basically get what's called monopoly pricing. But the truth of the matter is that the federal government does a lot of the basic research. The drug companies end up then getting the right to monopolize the final product and charge the price that they want. So that's kind of a defect in the system, is that there's lots of public investment. The government helps create a public good, and then that good is converted for private monopoly purposes with very little restriction on the eventual price. There's other kinds of subsidization for drug companies as well. The tax system certainly subsidizes all of the research and development costs. Those are all tax deductible, and some of them have special tax treatment. So when you look at it, there's a lot of government subsidy, both direct through research expenditures and indirectly through tax breaks for research and development.
I think there are even maybe more types of government subsidy that they're not even normally mentioned. I was thinking, if I personally became a researcher and took a job with a pharmaceutical company, and let's say in the first few years I was there, I made them a great discovery. I did some wonderful work that was going to make them a lot of money. Thinking about what went into me, I've entire grade school education at the university, I did much of that at public expense, virtually all of it, state schools. I went to medical school at a state school. And even if you don't get your training at formally state schools, there's tremendous government subsidy of the whole medical education process. And I would assume that's the case for most types of medical careers and not just medical doctors. So is that ever factored into this equation?
Well, I think it's not acknowledged very frequently publicly that the expertise that is acquired and embedded in people is actually publicly supported in exactly the way you describe. There's kind of this false image or mythology about this lone inventor who's self-created, who toils away and discovers something, and the only way he or she's going to be rewarded is to get a monopoly on the invention. And if you don't give them the monopoly, they won't be interested in innovation. I don't know whether that was true even for Benjamin Franklin, but as you describe it, now people aren't self-made. People were never self-made, but increasingly it's because of the public infrastructure, the public support for education, exactly as you describe it, that tremendously subsidized the human capacity that then gets put to work for increasingly privatized interests. And so, yeah, that's another, I think, critique of this kind of myth of why we must reward innovation to the extent we do. It's kind of this myth that, you know, this lonely person would not be able to survive without it. And, of course, most research scientists are well paid by their institutions. They have lots of government support. They were supported in being created with the expertise they have. So it's a good point that you raise.
You said that in the United States, there's for a 20-year period from the filing of a new chemical entity or a drug application, the company can then be the sole producer and essentially set the price wherever they want to. Now, how does that work internationally? I assume the United States would want other countries to respect the patents that our government grants.
The first thing to realize is the patents are granted by each and every country separately. In other words, if I'm company A and I get a patent in the U.S., that doesn't give me a patent in Canada. That doesn't give me a patent in Zimbabwe. You have to file your patent application in each country where you want that patent protection. So there's no such thing as a global patent. Now, drug companies actually do this strategically and to save money. So if they actually could predict that a particular medicine was going to be a blockbuster everywhere in the world, they'd patent everywhere in the world. But as I said before, there's lots of dead ends. So what they do is they patent selectively. They patent in the big markets of Canada, the U.S., Europe, and Japan. By the way, those four markets comprise nearly 90% of the global market of pharmaceutical sales by dollar volume.
And that hardly would describe 90% of the world's disease burden.
No, that would be 10% of the world's disease burden. But they file their protection in rich markets, and then they file selectively in poor countries. And they typically file in countries that have a rich elite and middle class that can buy some medicines, you know, particularly the bigger countries. And they also file in countries that have manufacturing capacity, the ability to manufacture pharmaceuticals like India has. And they do that to kind of protect their rights wherever a competitor could otherwise come onto the scene. So what happens is when the drug company gets its patent, it has to get that patent approved. But if it is approved, then it has the same kind of monopoly right in that country as it would have for the patent in the U.S. The drug companies gain this right to have a standard set of patent rights, as I said earlier, through this 1994 agreement, the TRIPS agreement. And that set minimum standards for patent and copyright and trademark worldwide. And one of those new requirements is that all patents granted be at least 20 years long, that all patents be available in all fields of technology, because historically many, many countries, in fact, as recently as 25 years ago, over 50 countries did not grant patents on pharmaceutical products or medicines. They just thought that they were too important a public good to be subject to monopoly pricing. But the TRIPS agreement changed that, and the reason it changed it, frankly, was because the pharmaceutical industry joined with some other intellectual property industries like the recording industry and the software industry, and they said, we want an intellectual property system worldwide. And they got the U.S. Trade Representative and the European negotiators to agree to that, and then basically into a system that was supposed to promote free trade, which is the World Trade Organization, they imposed a monopoly system. It's kind of a huge paradox that you're supposed to reduce trade barriers, but partly what you're doing is perpetuating global monopolies. But that's the deal that got struck. So the consequence of this is that drug companies can make the choice in a particular country to say, well, we're going to patent, we're going to register the product there as well, you know, go through the drug regulatory process, and then we'll be able to set the price we want to maximize our profits. The price they usually and historically have set in developing countries in the absence of competition is a price nearly the same as in the U.S., and that will get the most profit from the small group of rich people in that country who can afford the medicine. So the ultimate consequences of this new global system was that rich countries can afford medicines, rich elites in poor countries can afford medicines, but that the patent system gives the company the right to prevent the supply of medicines to the vast majority of poor people in developing countries who can't afford, nor can their governments afford, to buy the medicines. So that's the fundamental contradiction in the global system right now, is we've created a system, or we've allowed drug companies to create a system with the support of the U.S. government that prioritizes sales to rich people and rich countries and simultaneously acts to prevent sales to poor people.
And what are the implications for public health in those poor countries?
Well, I'm an AIDS activist, and there are 40 million people living with HIV. Over 6 million of them need access to treatment immediately. And if the prices of medicines are too high, they will die, and they have died by the tens of millions already.
Well, let's take a short break. I'm Marvin Malik, and this is Public Health Radio. My guest today is Brooke Baker, and we're discussing drug patents, their rationale, and their impact on public health, especially in the poorer countries of the world. After the break, we'll look at some examples of the public health impacts of trade policies and some potential solutions to the problem. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik, host of today's show. My guest is Brooke Baker, and we've been looking at the reasons why drug prices are so high, even for medications essential in the treatment of HIV disease, and even in countries which can't possibly afford to pay the prices the pharmaceutical companies are charging. Now back to the interview. And tell us about the role India played in all this.
It is the pharmacy for the poor. A huge breakthrough occurred in access to medicines because India was permitted under international laws and its own national laws to produce some of the first generation of AIDS medicines generically. It was doing so completely lawfully, and it reduced the price of medicines that had cost $10,000 a year per patient in the U.S., to the first offer they made to Doctors Without Borders was $350 a year. So basically for 3.5 cents on the dollar, they said we can produce these medicines for profit and sell them to developing countries and many more people living with HIV could then access those medicines and have their lives extended.
Are you saying that they were allowed to do that before the patent had run out?
They were able to do it because India was one of the countries that did not grant patents on medicines. And so its scientists were able to lawfully reverse engineer a medicine that might have been patented in the U.S. and produce it in India. And then the global system permitted India to do that. There was nothing in the WTO agreement that said that act with respect to pre-existing medicines was unlawful. And it could sell them to countries where the pharmaceutical company had decided not to issue patents. So again, even on HIV medicines, there are many countries in Africa that the companies hadn't bothered to file patents in. So we had a...
Wait a minute, what would stop the United States? Like, the cost of HIV drugs is a major issue for many states, New York, California,
right.
Many states, Florida. What would stop our state governments from buying medications from those Indian drug companies?
Because in the U.S. there's a patent, and that patent prohibits manufacture, sale, or importation of a generic version of the patented medicine. See, that's what a patent system does. It gives you the right, the patent holder, the pharmaceutical company, the right to exclude competitors.
So you're saying that in India and in many poor countries, the companies may not have tried to file for a patent. So they would benefit from this, but if there's other countries that have more wealthy people, they can't benefit from it.
Absolutely, and just to give you some examples, I mean, I've done a lot of work in South Africa. Almost all the AIDS medicines are patented in South Africa. So it was prohibited legally from accessing these Indian medicines, even though it has, 5.5 million people who are living with HIV. Some other smaller sub-Saharan countries didn't have any patents on file. The companies hadn't bothered to file at all. But the point to emphasize is India was able to do this under the law that existed before TRIPS, and TRIPS didn't change its right to manufacture those older drugs, those pre-1995 drugs.
TRIPS is the trade agreement, isn't it?
It's the WTO agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. So it's
the World Trade Organization.
World Trade Organization. So developing countries can still access older medicines from India. But with HIV and for lots of other conditions, and as you certainly know, newer medicines are important. People develop resistance to the first-line therapies. People have bad side effects to some of those drugs. And increasingly, they need to access second-line combination therapies. And those medicines, which are more widely patented and for which patent applications have actually been filed in India because they're newer medicines, those are the drugs that face a continuing crisis with respect to. It's the availability of newer drugs where India cannot any longer produce generics at will. That's the real complication in access to medicine for poor people now. Because, for the older antiretroviral drugs for people living with HIV/AIDS, the price from Indian companies has gone below $130 a year now. It's down from $350 to under $130. And as the efficiencies increase and as the volume of those medicines increase, the experts estimate that the cost could go as low as $70 a year. That really increases access to medicine. That really increases affordability. It means governments can pay, especially when they're supported by donors, and it means that more and more people in the countries can help contribute to those costs out of pocket if necessary, at least middle income people. So, we have this demonstration of how important generic competition is, and yet we've got a new intellectual property regime, which makes it very hard for there to be generic competition.
The other country that stands out was Brazil. Didn't they make an announcement that they were planning on getting every single HIV-infected person in their country treated?
Yeah.
And how are they going to afford that?
Okay. Well, Brazil's a great story because, as you said, it committed to universal free access to AIDS treatment essentially as soon as effective triple therapies were discovered. It, too, was able to use a window in that international agreement to make some of the earlier AIDS medicines generically without running afoul of the intellectual property rules. So what Brazil did is it said, well, the drug companies won't give us a discount. They're still saying we're going to sell it to you for $10,000 per person per year. And Brazil said, well, we'll make some of these at our own pharmaceutical plant. And they did.
And violate the patent.
It did not violate the patent because the patent holders, the Brazilian law at that point did not require or permit patents on pharmaceutical products. Brazil had the same kind of legal system that India had, which is medicines are too important to patent. So Brazil, because it wasn't required to retroactively change its law, made some of those older medicines and drove the price down dramatically for its own patients. And simultaneously what Brazil did is it created a market for the basic ingredients that are used in antiretroviral drugs. The new volume that was being produced meant that the price went way down. So to some extent, Brazil was incredibly important in the global system that reduced the price of ARVs because they made the market for active pharmaceutical ingredients. And then the Indian company started making it even larger volumes and achieved greater price decreases.
And ARV, you were referring to, those are drugs for HIV infection.
Yeah, those are antiretroviral therapies,
right.
Sorry, yeah.
So you're saying that the new trade agreement has been in effect now for a couple years, in full effect. And I was wondering if you could give some examples of what implications this has had, of where these battles are now being fought out, and what the implications are for the public health.
Okay, good. That's a great question. Well, I mean, let me just clarify one thing, which I probably haven't spoken about yet, that even though developing countries gave up a lot when they agreed to have these new heightened intellectual properties agreements, they also had some flexibilities guaranteed to them to override patents under certain circumstances. So there's something called compulsory licenses, which means that the government can basically say, we need this medicine for a reason which is important to us, and countries are allowed to describe those reasons for themselves. And we're going to let someone else, either domestically or elsewhere, manufacture the medicine and we'll be able to supply it to our population. And the patent holder, the drug company, gets a small what's called royalty or licensing fee from that new manufacturer.
These countries then wouldn't face the massive charges for drugs that
right.
they otherwise would have
faced. The generic companies, when a compulsory license is produced, can really sell closer to the marginal cost of production. So they can sell for pennies or dimes on the dollar. Right. So the price drops dramatically when a compulsory license is issued. So this is a flexibility that countries have. So this is kind of a background for what I'm going to describe to you next. The U.S. government and drug companies hate the fact when countries try to use the flexibilities that they have. So the first case like that was in the late 1990s when...
No, wait, let me just stop you for a second. You said that the U.S. I can see why the drug companies would not be pleased because they may be losing a share of their market at the high prices they like to charge. They do charge. But you also said the U.S. government is unhappy.
Right.
Why would our government not want countries facing desperate public health crises, millions of individuals affected with HIV or tuberculosis, why wouldn't our government want them to be treated at the least cost possible?
That's a great question. I think there are a couple explanations. I think the key explanation is that the drug companies have actually convinced the U.S. government to protect the drug companies' interests.
Was this also true during the Clinton administration?
Absolutely. The Clinton administration threatened trade sanctions against the South African government because it was using a law. It proposed a new law to search for cheaper medicines sold by the brand name company, but sold cheaper someplace else. So if a medicine was sold cheaper in Thailand, South Africa wanted to buy it there instead of from the same company that wouldn't offer it at a lower price in South Africa. Another completely lawful provision. It's called parallel importation. But what happened is the U.S. government threatened trade sanctions against South Africa, and simultaneously 39 companies sued the South African government. And that case continued from 1998 to 2001 when finally worldwide protests forced the drug companies to withdraw the lawsuit. So that was one early battle that showed this kind of collusion of interest between the drug companies and the U.S. government. A second wave of things that's happened is that the U.S. government is seeking higher intellectual property protections for drug companies in free trade agreements that it negotiates with developing countries and developing country regions. So these provisions are called TRIPS Plus. In other words, they're more than required under the WTO TRIPS agreement. They're additional intellectual property protections which extend monopolies or make the monopolies stronger. And so the U.S. has been negotiating those in South America and Central America, in the Middle East, and now increasingly in Asia. And it even had negotiations that it sought such increased protections with the five most southern countries in Africa, including South Africa.
And the motive these countries would have for agreeing to it is that they're sacrificing their ability to treat these public health catastrophes that many of these countries are facing, but the advantage is that then all of their companies have access to the U.S. market. Is that the concept?
Well, they feel that some of their companies or particularly their agricultural sectors might have more access to the U.S. market, and everyone wants to get to the U.S. market. I think because of very bad policies in their own countries are sometimes willing to trade health for the sale of cotton or something else. Recently, the drug companies have kind of stepped out from behind the curtain again because they got such negative publicity about the South Africa case that they basically stayed backstage for almost 6 years. They basically kept a low profile and let the U.S. government do the work for them in these trade agreements. But more recently, Novartis, which is a Swiss company, has sued the Indian government to try to make it easier to get patents on medicines than India did in its new patent act. India elected, as it's permitted to do under international law, to have strict standards for what constitutes a patentable pharmaceutical product. And it really requires something that is, in essence, brand new and has an inventive step. And Novartis was denied a patent on a minor variation of existing medicine called Gleevec, which is an important anti-leukemia medicine. And Novartis not only challenged the decision on Gleevec, but it also then challenged the entire Indian patent system with respect to the definition of what kinds of drugs should be patented. So it wants it to be easier for minor variations and new uses of existing or pre-existing medicines to get another 20-year monopoly. So that's one kind of new pharma offensive that's very problematic, and there's worldwide protests that have been lodged against Novartis.
And pharma refers to the whole pharmaceutical sector that patents, creates new drugs.
Right. The catchphrase is big pharma. The big drug companies, Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, Bristol-Myers Squibb, these are familiar names. Anyone who goes into their medicine cabinet and looks at the manufacturer on a prescription medicine, these are the companies whose names they see. Another big case is a case in Thailand, where the Thai government is one of the few countries that has finally issued a compulsory license to allow a generic producer to make a cheaper version of AIDS drugs, and for the first time for heart medicine. And again, it's completely lawful, as I said earlier, under international law. The TRIPS Agreement, Article 31, specifically provides for compulsory licenses, and the whole world in a declaration in 2001 said that the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health said that countries could prioritize public health and ensure access to medicine for all, and the U.S. signed on to that. But once a country has tried to use that, the drug companies and the U.S. government go ballistic, and the Wall Street Journal goes ballistic, and they try to call Thailand, pirates and breaking the patent system and everything, because they've decided selectively for medicines that are very important in their public health system to issue compulsory licenses so they can get the drugs substantially cheaper than pharma was willing to sell it for. But anyway, to show you how extreme the drug companies will go, not only are they jumping up and down about the compulsory licenses in Thailand, but Abbott, which is really one of the worst acting drug companies in terms of maximizing its intellectual property rights, has actually withdrawn medicines from the drug regulatory system in Thailand and said it will not introduce any new medicines in Thailand. Now, one of those medicines is a new version of Kaletra, a very important AIDS medicine. And what Novartis had discovered was a way to make that heat stable. So it's much more useful in tropical countries like Thailand, because the old version of Kaletra, this medicine, had to have a cold supply, which meant it had to have a cold supply through its whole distribution system, and the patient typically had to have a refrigerator to keep it cool so that it wouldn't degrade. And what Abbott has decided to do is say, well, we're going to take our marbles and go home. We're going to take this new improved medicine out of the drug regulatory system. We're not going to let you have it because you've used a lawful flexibility. And this is one of the things that I think makes treatment activists so incensed at drug companies, is that the tactics they use in defense of their intellectual properties exceed all moral bounds. I mean, how can you take an extremely important medicine off the market completely to try to prove a point? When the discoveries have been subsidized, as we talked before, by federal dollars, when the human resources that make these discoveries have been supported, when the medicines themselves are a public good, a global public good, and when human beings have a human right of access to essential medicines, if we leave that monopoly control in the hands of drug companies, we're crazy as a species. Why should someone die because a drug company says, I want to prove a point to your government?
So is there a controversy among the powerful countries in the world about this? Like, you're saying that the United States, under both major political parties, has basically towed the line for the pharmaceutical industry. But are there other countries, is there at least some disagreement? Are there other developed countries that are pushing for more flexibility and showing concern for the public health problems across the poorer countries?
Sometimes, yes. Some of the European countries sometimes publicly state that they think that developing countries should not be intimidated and threatened when they use lawful flexibilities. So, you know, the United Kingdom just, you know, said that yesterday at a meeting, that they think Thailand should be permitted to use its flexibilities. They didn't directly criticize the U.S. They didn't directly criticize Abbott. But they did say, you know, countries have these flexibilities and should be permitted to do it. The WTO has, in fact, said that. Major international consultations, you know, groups of experts that have been put together to study the intellectual property system, have said that countries need to be able to use their flexibilities. The World Health Organization, over and over again, has said developing countries need these flexibilities to access cheaper medicines so that they can respond to the public health needs of their populations.
Thailand is not the poorest country in the world by any means, but it's a fairly poor country overall. And is it really that important for Abbott or any other drug company to be able to charge the higher prices in Thailand? Like,
right.
What is,
right.
Why do these little poor countries with only small numbers of wealthy people, why are they so important to these drug companies? Is this a demonstration event, or what? Why are they
pushing this so hard?
Drug companies are coming under increasing price pressure in the U.S. and Europe because of their outrageous prices. And consumers and doctors are starting to rebel, as are companies. And they fear that there's going to be more pressure on their profits in their richest country markets. So then they look at the other 10% of the world, all developing countries, comprise only 10% of the global pharmaceutical market. And they say, well, maybe that's where we need to grow in the future. And they look at countries like Thailand, and they look at countries like Brazil and India and China and say, you know, there's some rich people there, and there's growing middle classes, and there's people who can afford insurance or who can pay for drugs out of pocket, and we want access to those customers. We want access to those customers even if it means that the other 95% of the population goes without. But we want to make those sales, and we want to make those sales at high prices. Novartis has said this explicitly with respect to India. It said there's a middle class in India, and we have a right to sell to rich people. And that's why we're trying to protect our patent.
So it sounds like you're not buying the argument that these pharmaceutical companies need to have huge profits because that's what's going to get us new drugs. That's what's going to fund their research.
Well, this is
argument.
Is a fundamental point that almost never gets explained to the national press, and I'm really glad that you're taking the time to ask the question. The question is, would the sales in 10% of the market be absolutely essential to research and development decisions?
The 10%, you mean the
poor
countries?
All developing countries put together, Latin America, all of Asia, and all of Africa together. Does that 10% of global sales, is that crucial to Pfizer's decisions on research and development? Or to state it more bluntly, where the poorest countries are, all of Asia and all of Africa comprise about 5% of the global market. Do we really think that we have to restrict access to medicines there because that extra 5% of potential profit is so important to the research and development decisions that are made in the U.S.? I mean, the answer is no. Economically, it can't make that kind of difference. But that's the argument they use. The argument they use is, well, we need research and development. They try to make an argument that if there's some restriction on their profits in Thailand, that undoes their profit incentive everywhere else in the world. And it's just a false argument. They continue to make their very high markup sales and make huge profits for research and development in the rich markets of North America, Europe, and Japan. They make huge profits there, more than enough to fund research and development. In fact, they make more in profit than they spend on research and development. And they spend 2.5 times as much on marketing and administration as they do on research and development. And much of the research and development they engage in does not prioritize diseases of poor people in poor countries. And it doesn't really prioritize new medicines. There are a lot of me too medicines. You know, someone's come up with a good product. Let me see if I can, you know, grab some of that market share. You know, how many erectile dysfunction drugs do we need? But because there is Viagra, now we have to have 3 other ones. So we got some perverse incentives in the patent system that do not serve the interests, even of rich consumers, frankly, but certainly don't serve the interests of poor consumers, even in the U.S., but most certainly in developing countries.
Now, are there alternatives to the whole point of the patent system was to, as you pointed out at the beginning of this interview, was to reward pharmaceutical companies and other medical equipment companies that are producing innovative, useful new medications. Is there an alternative to the patent system that doesn't give these companies the right to charge just exorbitant, just ridiculous prices that are completely unaffordable, both in the poor countries as well as for many people in the U.S.? Is there an alternative system that would still motivate these companies to do research?
Well, there is. I mean, and people, you know, there's a process going on now at the World Health Organization to try to investigate some of these new systems for trying to help innovation and access simultaneously. So there's, you know, one set of proposals concerns prize funds. We're basically, you know, a smart group of scientists and public officials get together and say, well, we need more TB medicines and we need more malaria medicines and we need some medicines for dengue fever. So we're going to give special incentives for discoveries in these so-called neglected diseases.
A prize.
But then if the medicine's discovered, then the priority would be to get lots of generic or several generic companies to make it cheaply and make it accessible.
So, without waiting 20 years.
Yeah, without having to wait 20 years during a period of excessive monopoly pricing. And there's lots of simpler solutions before you go all the way to that. There should be much more pressure on drug companies to issue licenses to generic companies for developing countries. I'll tell you the truth. Pfizer does not want to use its scarce manufacturing capacity to produce high volumes of low markup goods. It's not its business model. And it's not making those high volume sales to poor people because it's not selling the drugs on that basis. It should give licenses to generic companies to supply poor people in poor countries.
But Pfizer isn't doing it.
But it isn't doing it. I mean, few companies have been forced to it. I mean, that's one of the kind of campaigns that activists work on. You know, Gilead has given a number of licenses on its medicine, tenofovir, because of activist pressure. So, you know, there's 11 or 12 licenses now in South Africa and in India for its medicine. And that's because, you know, activists basically said, you know, we need generic competition. And, you know, it's a perfect example of, you know, there being a solution available. So the answer to your question is, yeah, there's lots of things we could do better and differently. And we ought to be convincing and forcing our government decision makers to do it, and we ought to make it clear to the drug companies that they can no longer justify the practices which are killing people in developing countries. Their intellectual property rights are not so important that people have to die for them.
U.S. trade policy has fostered the development of a situation where HIV-infected patients or people with other major health problems in poor countries and their governments are having to pay higher prices for medications. But a lot of these medications are purchased, ultimately, the money is coming from donor countries. And the U.S. is one of those donor countries. So are we actually, for the amount of aid we give, however much it is, are we actually getting less medication because we're paying higher prices for these?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the huge contradictions. You've got this new global AIDS initiative, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, on its path to spend over $18 billion over a five-year period, nearly 50% of that spent on medicines. And the U.S. government is paying higher prices because it's insisting on protecting drug companies. You know, it's crazy. It's asking the drug, you know, it's asking U.S. taxpayers once again to subsidize drug companies, and doing so in a situation that actually means that one patient will be treated instead of three for the same dollar. It's a crazy system where the government is taking away with its left hand through intellectual property rights the global health initiatives that it's pursuing with its right hand through the global AIDS policy.
And the beneficiary is the pharmaceutical company.
And the beneficiary is the pharmaceutical company. Just like the beneficiary of the no negotiation on, you know, Medicaid drugs was the drug companies. An extra $100 billion over a period of years to the drug companies for that as well.
You made it sound as if political activism is a crucial part of this battle to get medications to these poor countries. And if that's the case, then what would you like listeners to do who are concerned about this?
Well, I would like listeners to let their members of Congress know that this is an important issue, that access to medicine is important in the U.S., and access to medicine is equally important for people in other countries. And that instead of spending our trade representative and our State Department spending all of its time and energy trying to get more intellectual property protections and therefore higher prices in developing countries, that we want them to change that policy. We want them to prioritize access to medicines for people in developing countries, because global health is a global good. More people who are well elsewhere means there's less sickness circling the globe. It means that other people's economies are stronger, which might actually help our economy. It's a win-win situation if global health improves. They also need to put pressure on drug companies and say, this is not okay. There's lots of shareholders. There's lots of people who have a way of getting, you know, their point of view across to drug companies and say, you know, there's got to be some limit to greed. You know, this it's not okay to let people die so you make some more money off a rich person in India. That's simply not okay. To Abbott, you can't take your medicine off the shelf in Thailand because you're upset that someone's using a lawful flexibility. It's not okay. We're going to scorn you in public opinion.
Well, Brooke Baker, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It's really been a pleasure, and you've been a great interviewer and have asked terrific questions.
The websites of Oxfam International and Doctors Without Borders include useful information on this issue, as well as suggestions for web browsers to take action. HealthGap, the organization Professor Baker leads, addresses this issue also and has a wealth of helpful information. That website is healthgap.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.